We'll talk with the author of A Bigger Prize this hour about the risks associated with hyper-competitiveness and how we can achieve so much more through collaboration. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will discuss the price we pay for so much competition in our society. Competition is everywhere. It's in our workplaces, in education, in sports, in medicine, everywhere, really. We will talk about what our guest says is a better way and welcome your questions and your views. Do you think competition is a good thing or not, and why or why not? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Margaret Heffernan. She's an entrepreneur, chief executive, author. Her most recent book is A Bigger Prize, How We Can Do Better Than the Competition. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks very much for being with us. So tell us, what's so bad about competition?
Well, I think, you know, for really trivial things and just for fun, I think it's fine. I don't think there's anything evil about playing Monopoly with your kids. And I think if you're trying to get them to go for a walk in the woods, turning it into a race is quite a good way to start. But I, you know, what my book is really looking at is the degree to which we've allowed competition become the kind of dominant motivator in all walks of life, from sport, but in science, in schools, in business, and everywhere I look to see how it actually played out, it seemed to be having pretty extraordinary effects that were negative, unexpected, and yet really pretty predictable.
Yeah, what are some
and
of the?
That's really what led me to write the book.
Mm-hmm. What sorts of negative effects?
Well, for example, one of the things that we've seen in the school system is that as we've turned education over more and more to competitive exams, competitive class rankings, competitive entry for college, competitive placings within classes, that the message that kids have absorbed from that is all that really matters is to win, and if all that matters is to win, does it really matter how? And this is a problem not just because, of course, it's in the nature of competition that a few will win and most will lose. So we've embraced a system that is guaranteed to deliver a disproportionate percentage of losers. But the other thing is that when we think about education and what we want to educate our kids for, you know, we really have very little idea of the knowledge, skills, and aptitudes they're going to need in the future. We know that technology is going to disrupt almost every profession that we know, and we don't know where jobs will be or what they will need. The only thing we can be completely certain of is that we will need people to have a real love of learning and to be fantastically good learners. And that's specifically what we're disabling by this highly competitive, high-stakes, winner-takes-all school system. We're not teaching them to love learning. We're teaching them to hate it.
You know, what evidence is there that it's competition that's teaching kids to hate learning?
Well, first of all, you can see that the statistics around cheating in school have been going up for the last 20 years. Rush Kidder at the Institute for Ethics estimates that by the time kids get to college, 95% of them have cheated on at least one exam. You can see that every university now makes their students put everything through plagiarism software to see who's cheating, because the scale of cheating is so enormous. And when you talk to kids about, well, why did you cheat, you know, they'll say, well, you know, I've been told my whole life everything depends on this. You even have situations where parents have encouraged them to cheat, because if that's the only way they can get a high ranking in their class position, that's what their mothers and fathers want them to do. We have this whole rhetoric now that says if you aren't in a top school, top of the class, top grades, top everything, you're toast. And with that kind of rhetoric, the notion that you're going to go to school and learn to love studying, love learning new skills. That is nowhere in our vocabulary. And it's making teachers, of course, leave teaching because they didn't go in there just to drill kids for exams. But it means that by the time you get kids to university, and even sometime to graduate school, you know, all they're thinking about is the grades. I've had MBA students who, you know, are studying, hoping to be entrepreneurs. And the first question they ask me is, you know, how are you going to grade our work? Mm. I cannot think of anything less relevant to entrepreneurship than grades. And yet, really, this has now become their exclusive focus on what should be their own personal development.
So where did the glorification of competition in our culture come from?
Well, I think some of it comes from a real misunderstanding of Darwin and evolution. So I think some people imagine that what natural selection is, which got translated by Herbert Spencer into survival of the fittest, or that what it really means is that only the best survive. Now, Darwin spent a vast amount of his life looking at why all species collaborate so effectively. So I think it's a kind of mangling of a subtle concept and turning it into a simple one. It's also definitely the case that, you know, if you put two cyclists in a room, they will cycle faster against each other than on their own, and faster against the clock than on their own. So it's very easy to think, well, wow, if they're going to work harder because they're feeling competitive, then surely that's how I should motivate people at work. The problem is it doesn't really carry over. Why? Well, partly because even in the cycling exercise, after a while, most cyclists give up. If they can't win, why should they bother to keep trying so hard? So the effort isn't infinite or sustainable. And the second thing is that at work, of course, what it does is it gives people a sense of being constantly under threat. Now, no one does their best work under a constant sense of threat. And as increasingly we're asking people at work to be creative, to be innovative, to be learning new skills and applying them to new activities, doing so under a sense of threat is absolutely the worst conditions in which to try to get great work out of people.
Mm-hmm. So what is the bigger prize that you reference in the title of your book?
Well, the bigger prize is really what we can get, and certainly what many organizations get, when instead of embracing competition, they start to address, I think, much more thoughtfully, what are the conditions in which people do their most collaborative and creative work. And what's really clear, whether you're studying academic exercises and research, whether you're studying experiments, or whether you're studying real-life organizations, and I look at all of that kind of data, is that people tend to do their best work when they know and trust their coworkers. They actually like their coworkers, but they feel that they're working in a safe environment, where they feel high degrees of trust, and they also trust the people alongside them. When they have a challenge that isn't impossible, but it's a stretch, and when they have lots of different kinds of people around them with which to interact, and where there's a very low hierarchy, so they don't have a sense that they're invisible, and they don't have a sense that they're kind of competing to get to the top. And you can see in some of the world's most creative and successful organizations, you know, whether you're looking at companies like Ocean Spray or whether you're looking at companies like Arup that build some of the world's most cutting-edge buildings in the world, or W.L. Gore that registers more patents than most businesses in the world, you can see that it's creating those conditions that lies underneath their decades and decades of success.
So if they are, if these companies are the most creative and successful, and they're getting the bigger prize, how come everybody's not emulating that?
Well, I think what's really interesting is I think we may be experiencing a sort of sea change. So one of the things I wrote about is that most companies use an appraisal and reward system called forced ranking. And in forced ranking, what you do is you assess everybody regularly. You identify the bottom 10% and throw them out. You identify the top 10% and give them all sorts of training and rewards. And then you kind of leave the middle 80% to kind of muddle along. And over half the companies in the United States and in Europe use these systems because they used to think that this was really how you got great work out of people. And what's become clear over the years is that it doesn't work. It doesn't work because really great people don't want to work alongside each other because they're afraid they'll lose their place in the rankings. And everybody quickly identifies that actually the safest place to be is the middle. So don't try to be too smart. Don't try to be too clever. Be good enough. Be a pleaser. Keep your head down and try not to get noticed. And I think what's really interesting is the number of companies I see gradually backing away from these systems. They've been using them for 10 or 20 years. And what they're seeing is that it completely gets in the way of people collaborating. And perhaps most interesting is that although for the last 10 years, just about everybody in the world has been telling Microsoft that the reason they have an innovation problem is because of their forced ranking system, under the new CEO several months ago, they finally got rid of this system. Now what they're doing is they're talking about what they call one Microsoft. In other words, where all the pieces work together instead of against each other.
We are talking with the author of A Bigger Prize, How We Can Do Better Than the Competition, who says a bigger prize is achievable not through fierce competition, but through collaboration. We welcome your questions for her, and we'll talk more about how we see competition in other aspects of society, talk some about education and business, but what about science and medicine? Would we have ever gotten to the moon if it weren't for competition? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Do you think that we have an overly competitive society? Do you think that fierce competition is good or bad for society? And what is a better way? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with the author of A Bigger Prize about the risks associated with hyper-competitiveness and how we can achieve so much more through collaboration, through cooperation, through trust and generosity. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions on competition for her at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Margaret Heffernan. She is an entrepreneur, a chief executive, and author. And I promise that we talk a little bit about competition in the worlds of medicine and science and discovery. A lot of people think that without competition, we might not have had the space race. We might not have ended up on the moon, and all sorts of discoveries wouldn't be made. What's your thought, Margaret, on that upside of competition? Are you sticking to your story?
Well, I think that if you talk to scientists, and I've been talking to scientists for years now, you know, what you discover is these are profoundly motivated people. What motivated the space race wasn't the notion of winning the space race. It was the notion of actually being able to do it at all. I think what's really striking today is that, we have a lot of extraordinarily serious environmental and medical challenges that we're facing. And increasingly, the environment in which scientists are working faces several problems. One is, I would say, hyper-intense competition for funding. So scientific funding in the United States has really not grown in real terms since the 1970s. And the consequence of that is there are more scientists than ever. We probably have more research to do than ever. But the competitiveness for the funding of it absorbs more time than the science itself in many cases. In addition, because whether or not you get funding is decided by things like how many publications you can show that you've produced, this has led scientists to take, say, one experiment or one collection of data and slice it into five or six different publications. Now, what that means is the work is really incoherent. It's very hard for other scientists to build on it, which is how science works. It's often produced very, very much too quickly, and a higher rate than ever is fraudulent. And the consequence of that is that the rate of retractions of scientific papers is at an all-time high. Now, it might sound like, well, you have to retract a science paper. What's so bad about that? Well, you can look at some of the major big science frauds in the last 10 years in the United States, in Korea, in China, all of these hyper-competitive environments for science, and see that because of the fraudulent papers, years and years of work were wasted going down avenues that fraudulent work suggested would be worthwhile. So on the one hand, we have less funding than ever. We have more misleading, incoherent, and fraudulent data than ever before that is resulting in more waste than ever before. And, of course, the consequence of that is that many, many scientists just grow too discouraged and leave. They go and work in banks where they're going to get better paid and they have a better chance of seeing some of their ideas come to fruition. So the notion that we have today more scientific knowledge than ever before and more need of it than ever before, and we are wasting it at a rate greater than ever before, I think is really alarming.
Yeah. The Human Genome Project was one example of a project that set out to accomplish something as a collaboration, but it also became competitive. Is there any way to truly eliminate competition from endeavors?
Well, I think what's really fascinating about the Human Genome Project is that, if it had been left alone, it would still have done its work. The human genome is the human genome. You can't produce a better one. And actually, the competition was a kind of sideshow and a phenomenal waste of money. The competition between the privately funded project and the publicly funded global collaboration didn't create anything new. It simply made what was done more expensive. So it's a classic example of competition not doing at all what people think it will do. And I think actually what's really interesting about the Human Genome Project is how profoundly successful it was and the degree to which, because of it, most genes now are in the public domain, which means that it is far easier for the entire global community of science to work with it. None of that would have happened if the competitive private venture had succeeded. So I think I think science has the potential to model collaboration in a truly spectacular way. And I think that, St. John Sulston, who ran the Human Genome Project, is really one of the great leaders of our time. But it's interesting that we remember it as a race. We don't remember the pointlessness of it being a race. And I think now we kind of tend to undervalue the terrific intellectual achievement that it was.
We are talking with the author of A Bigger Prize, How We Can Do Better Than the Competition, Margaret Heffernan. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And let's go to the phones. Dennis and Racine is with us. Hello, Dennis.
Yes, thank you. I love what you're saying. I've had exactly the same thoughts for many years. I read Alfie Kahn's book published in the 1980s about competition, and you're amplifying and reinforcing what he has said. I found that in our society, competition and economic competition has reached a really absurd extremes, like carrying wife races and that kind of thing, pumping contests, everything. It bothers me, but I want to point out that the media, I believe, support most of this uncritically. My local paper I've read for years, and I've seen this get to the point where they have some kind of supposedly fun competition locally played up almost every issue. There are some 80 articles I found a few years ago in the paper about non-sports competition. I did my own survey during 1 month. So I think, as you said, it undercuts basic morality and has very little going for it, but the paper, media in general, I don't see much critical analysis of the role of competition in our society. It's supportive all the way through. And this, I mean, you know, when you see, for instance, in the A-plus section about academics, you have about 7 articles playing up some kind of competition like geography among kids, geography and...
Let me get our guest to react to that. So I was going to ask Dennis to clarify for me what competitions he was seeing being, you know, publicized in the paper. And it sounds like contests for school children, like geography bees or spelling bees. Is there anything so much wrong with that, Margaret?
Well, I think it depends how far that's a kind of temporary game and how far it's the routine language of learning. So I think it's really important that we can still happily use competition for games that don't count, that are just for fun. I think exactly the same thing about sport. What I think is so dangerous is the degree to which we've allowed competition to become the single overriding motivator, you know, for very, very high stakes prizes. So I think if you say to kids, you know, shall we have a contest on, you know, a geography contest just for fun, I don't see any problem with that at all. I think when the results of that contest determine, you know, your grade and whether or not you get to go move up in school, I think that's a very different thing altogether. And I think, you know, what's really striking to me as I've talked to children around the world is I have no doubt that, you know, that kids love to learn. Kids are sponges. Where they start to lose their passion for learning is their sense of failure and their sense that that they can't achieve. And I think that's what we need to be speaking to. And instead what we're doing is we're just creating the conditions in which we'll celebrate a few superstars and pretty much forget the rest.
Yeah. Would you, if you ruled the world, would you get rid of those, the national televised spelling bees?
Yeah, I would. But I think, you know, what's really interesting is that if you look at one of the highest achieving educational systems in the Western world, which is in Finland, what do you see in Finland? You see an education system that was designed by all parties in the government because there was a belief that education was too important to become a political football, and a belief that the country needed every single child to succeed. So those were the parameters, if you like. That was what would define their system, was one in which everyone succeeded. Several things jump out about that educational system. One is they have tests in order to see how kids are doing and so that they can check, is somebody falling behind? Is there something they don't understand? But they don't have any standardized tests across schools until age 16 or aged 18. Now, that does all kinds of really interesting things. First of all, it makes it very hard for pushy parents to compare their kids with each other. That's fantastically helpful. Secondly, it persuades the kids that they're there to learn. They're not there just for the grades. And thirdly, it's proved fantastically successful in terms of the very high proportion of kids who do very well, who go on to university, who go on to postgraduate work. And one of the highest status jobs in Finland is being a teacher. It's one of the jobs just about everybody wants to do. So they have the pick of people when it comes to choosing teachers. And the teachers themselves continue to do research. In other words, it's fundamental to this system that the teacher isn't some kind of god throwing out scraps of knowledge. The teacher continues to be a student throughout his or her professional career.
Our caller, Dennis, also brought up something that has been in the news in Wisconsin recently, I guess a silly story about race involving husbands carrying their wives on their shoulders. Mm-hmm. It was wife carrying races. I think this is actually a Norwegian custom or something, mm-hmm. some goofy race like this. I mean, is there any? You know, we also have outhouse races and barstool races and that kind of goofy kind of thing. Do you see any harm in that?
You see, I really don't, because I think they're just for fun. Mm-hmm. I don't have any problem with it at all. I think where competition really causes damage is when it gets used for stuff that really counts. You know, I think education really counts and science really counts. So I think it does a lot of damage there. But I have no problem with competition, as it were, just for fun. And it's interesting, you know, because I also interviewed a lot of musicians, because, of course, a lot of music is competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And what they said to me was a couple of really interesting things. First of all, the best musicians usually do quite poorly in contests, because contests are just judging one or two things, and really great musicians are complex. But they said for young musicians, they're just good experience. They're good performance experiences. And as long as the musician doesn't think that they matter, their music teachers will put them forward for them. They said they only do real damage to the musicians who think that this is a make-or-break experience. And it's really striking that in the kind of big music contests, you know, American Idol, that kind of stuff, that very, very few of those musicians, very, very few of the winners have any kind of long-term career. You know, because what you need to be a really successful musician long term, you have to be a great collaborator. You have to be somebody other musicians want to work with, and you have to be a musician who brings out the best in other people. And if all you're focused on is yourself, you're not going to be able to do that.
Next, we go to Mike in Waukesha. Hello, Mike.
How are you doing? Yeah. Margaret, every point that you've made, it is perfect. The one thing that I'm kind of taken back on, though, is getting away the competition in a competitive form. For myself, one of the best ways that I produce is during a competitive kind of outlook or outset on life. It's kind of with the idea of epigenetics. Mm-hmm. Your environmental factors play kind of who you are as a person to continue to grow and to continue to continue to evolve in this society. And for when you do things like the spelling bee, I think it's on the parents' aspect to give the child that sense of confidence in them. Even if they do lose, it's not going to be detrimental to them, and it's not going to ruin their psyche. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I think it's part of the
I think if the cost of losing isn't high, then that's what I would call competition just for fun. But I think what's
kind of
so damaging is when the sense is that winning is everything, and losing really does incur a real cost.
Mike, I'm sorry, Margaret. Mike is talking under you, and I just want to. So, Mike, what was the point you called in about, though?
I know definitely that for me, competition is one of the best things that continues to evolve my character as a person, from martial arts and for other types of things in my life, such as business and work, being around certain people that have certain aspects that kind of help me excel. It's definitely a competitive kind of atmosphere, and that continues to push me in the right direction. I'm just saying that Margaret's definitely on point, and I'm loving everything that she's been talking about, and I'm definitely going to read her book. And thank you for having me on the show, and continue to learn and grow. I appreciate everything you said today, so thank you.
I think what Mike says that's really interesting is I think many people have a great desire to do better. You know, I certainly have a desire to, you know, that this book be better than my last book. I want to write a better sentence tomorrow than I wrote today. And I think that's great because, of course, you know, on some level you can't lose if that's what you're trying to do. But I think in the big institutional structures we've set up, you know, whether it's corporations, whether it's governments, whether it's, you know, these gigantically overfunded sporting events, whether it's the financial system that we've set up, you know, competition has become such a phenomenal driver of those environments that it has led to, you know, very high levels of corruption, very high levels of cheating, and, of course, as a result, high levels of public distrust. I think it's, you know, I think there's something else I've been thinking about since, you know, since we're in Wisconsin, which is what's really set me down this path was in my previous book called Willful Blindness. I wrote about the degree to which almost all the banks had embraced subprime mortgages because that's what everybody else was doing. They were just so competitive they didn't stop to think how damaging these were. But not every bank did that. And one of the banks that didn't do it is in Wisconsin, which is R.W. Baird. And Baird is a great example of an incredibly successful organization that is built on and driven by a passion for collaboration. So one of the things that's really incredible about Baird is that Baird is owned by its employees. And as a consequence, they know that if they help each other, they're not going to lose their ranking. They're going to help the whole business. And since the whole business is something that they have an ownership stake in, they're profoundly motivated to help each other, to trust each other, and so on. I think this keeps them very much more grounded. I think it means that instead of thinking about what's the competition doing, they're more thinking about how do we best serve our customers, because that's what we're here for and that's how the company grows. And I think, you know, those of you lucky enough to live in Wisconsin should be incredibly proud of the fact that one of the few really healthy institutions in the banking crisis was right there.
Yes. Well, way to go, R.W. Baird. We will talk about other positive examples of collaboration and more on the downside of hyper competition as we continue talking with Margaret Heffernan. She is the author of A Bigger Prize, How We Can Do Better Than the Competition. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with the author of A Bigger Prize about the downside of competition and how we can achieve much more through collaboration. And we are welcoming your thoughts and questions on cooperation versus competition. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Bruce in Madison in an email asks you, Margaret Heffernan, to comment on the demise of the U.S. political system as one where competition has run amok.
Yeah, what can I say? It's interesting because I haven't written about this at great length, partly because there is an absolutely brilliant book called Winner Takes All Politics that says really everything that is to be said, I think, on the subject. But I think politics and particularly, sad to say, as an American citizen, American politics is in a really sorry state because people compete so ferociously. They've really lost the plot about what it is they're competing for. And, you know, each party is so convinced that all they want to do is make the other guy lose. But, of course, it seems to me that it's, you know, the American citizen that is losing. I think also the last chapter of my book, I looked at, you know, these, to my mind, rather ridiculous global ranking tables that look at, you know, who has the world's biggest economy. And I think that I think it's a very traumatic moment in our history to imagine that we might no longer be the global dominant economic power. And I think we're so attached to the idea of being top dog that it's leading to us being not a very good global partner. And yet when you think of the kind of challenges that we face, and you know, they're all global challenges. We found in the banking crisis, you know, the financial systems of the world are so profoundly interconnected. You can't separate them, and the American economy couldn't isolate itself from global repercussions. So I think there's a huge political challenge in the coming generation, which is it going to be possible for America to learn how to conduct itself as a great global partner? And, you know, I say this week I'm in the UK, and it's really struck me that on some level, Britain is still recovering from having lost its position as top dog when it had the British Empire. And the consequence is that there's an awful lot of political posturing, an awful lot of throwing the weight around. And, you know, really, this is just setting the country back, that we need very quickly to get to a point where we can sit around a table and hammer out some solutions to the very big problems we face. And as long as anybody comes to the table determined to be top dog, we're not going to be able to do that.
Let's take a call from Mark in Richland Center. Hello, Mark.
Good morning, and thank you for this program. Margaret, I am glad to talk to you because I'm also a Heffernan, but I really loved your willful blindness.
Oh, thank you.
And I saw the TED Talk. I hadn't read the book. But the connection between this collaboration thing and that willful blindness thing makes perfect sense, because the worship of individualism is probably what led to all of those downfalls, and yet you don't see this same kind of individualistic insanity in cultures that mostly the Western world have destroyed. And so one of the problems that we have in trying to understand how to be collaborative is that we killed off a lot of those social orders in lieu of an order that was basically descended out of feudalism.
Mm-hmm.
So in non-feudalistic societies, you don't see this same sort of thing. And the malady of individualism, wherein in a feudalistic society, the king or queen claims to be in charge of everybody, and then everybody else has to basically sell out in order to have standing.
So,
I think that's absolutely right, and it's interesting because, you know, I think my readers often understand my work better than I do. Because it was really only after finishing this book that I saw how kind of closely connected to willful blindness it really was. But I think you're right. I mean, one of the arguments in willful blindness is that, you know, leaders are blinded, if you like, by their own hype and by the isolation of power. And I think that, you know, competitiveness and winning in competitions has exactly the same impact, whether you're talking about individuals or whether you're talking about, you know, corporate or global leaders. But I would say that, you know, one of the things that's been really interesting about this book is I've gone around the world talking to lots of different kinds of organizations, from, you know, very large corporate senior executive teams to schools to kids to, you know, entrepreneurial organizations. And I have to say, I feel there's a real sea change coming in the sense that the big organizations are definitely reaching a point where they realize the way they're working doesn't work anymore. The younger generation is pretty sick of competing with itself constantly. They've been brought up on a diet of it for so long that they're really pretty fed up with it. And they don't look around and see that it's working for them or, in many cases, for their families. And so I think we're seeing, you know, a really different mood start to arise in which people are defining success instead of defining success as I managed to be top dog. They're starting to think, well, the way I'm successful is by helping the people around me to be successful. And that's certainly what you see in companies like Ocean Spray, where, you know, the CEO of that company said to me, you know, we aren't successful unless all of the 750 cranberry farmers that own us are successful. And they aren't successful unless we invent, you know, 100 million brilliant things to do with bitter little red fruits. So there's, I think, a growing understanding that we are fantastically interdependent and solo success comes at too great a cost.
We have a lot of those little bitter red fruits growing in Wisconsin, too.
Yeah, I know. And I mean, I started studying Ocean Spray because I was just dazzled by the myriad uses that the company invented to use what is, you know, a pretty unpromising proposition.
Mm-hmm.
And what's so interesting is that, you know, visiting the company and visiting the, you know, seeing the cranberry harvest and all this sort of thing is, it absolutely is a kind of community in which no one part of that business can succeed unless all the other parts succeed. And everybody knows that, whether you're a food scientist, an advertising executive, or a cranberry farmer. You all need each other.
Yeah. We have other callers, so let's go to David and Nina. Hello, David.
Hi. A couple comments. I think I fundamentally disagree with your guest. I think competition is one of the physical laws of this universe, just like gravity, and you ignore those factual, scientifically based realities at your own peril. The competition is why we have evolution. It explains survival of the fittest. Countries that acknowledge and embrace the existence of competition provide a better standard of living and more opportunities for their citizens. Capitalist America is a great example. It's the reason teachers in the U.S. make a lot more money than they do in the Soviet Union or Sweden or elsewhere. It's the reason we don't have an 85% income tax like they do in some of the Scandinavian countries. And you have to acknowledge, just like you have to acknowledge gravity if you want to learn to fly, you have to acknowledge the existence of competition if you want to get the most, if you want to move society the farthest and provide the best for the most people.
Well, let me get Margaret to address that point. I'll give you a follow-up, David. So it's a law of nature, Margaret.
Well, I've never, ever argued that we aren't all naturally competitive. I absolutely accept that. But my argument is simply we are competitive enough. And if you believe in evolution and you go back and you read Darwin, what you'll discover is that as much as he believed that natural selection was a fundamental part of evolution, he himself did not call it survival of the fittest. He also argued and spent the bulk of the second half of his career studying that species survive because of their ability to collaborate and to support each other. And this was really the big challenge of the second half of his life, which is what are the mechanisms by which we collaborate? How is it that we've learned to communicate? Because, of course, communication is the fundamental form of collaboration. How is it that almost all species have forms of collaboration? Because he was absolutely convinced that this was the other piece of evolution which made it so productive and so creative. So I wouldn't for a moment suggest that we ever could, even if we wanted to, eliminate competition. I'm simply saying that you have to have a really productive balance between the two, and I think we've overdone it. I think the other thing that's really important to bear in mind is no nation on earth has ever deployed competition as ferociously, as cruelly, and as inhumanely as the Soviet Union, which used it everywhere all the time. So, you know, that's just a fantastic, horrible, tragic irony about Soviet history, which is, having started out as a kind of great romantic movement, it ended up embracing competition to a degree that I don't think any American would ever stomach.
David?
With regard to the Soviet Union, it's a socialist country. They bend over backwards to eliminate competition. They celebrate mediocrity. They want everybody to be the same, same pay, drive the same car. Everything is based on tenure and how long you've been loitering in the halls, not on your talent, not on your competitive nature. It is the antithesis of competitive America, and that's why the standard of living is so low. And
but every factory in the USSR was made to compete with every other factory. Every farm was made to compete with every other farm. Every scientist was made to compete with every other scientist. I just don't agree with your facts. And having interviewed a very large number of Russians, you know, what they have said to me is it was when it came to the West that they learned to collaborate, because nothing in their system taught them how to do it. It was the most brutal live-or-die, sink-or-swim environment that they'd ever experienced. So I think their rhetoric of the Soviet Union has always been wildly at odds with the way in which, in fact, the country was governed. And, of course, far from producing any equality at all, it produced gross inequality between those at the top of the system who had luxury and freedom and those at the bottom of the system who had none. Mm. Now, I think our big concern in the United States and in Europe is that economically we're currently running the risk of recreating that great a polarization between the 1% and the 99%. And I think that's one of the biggest dangers we face as a society, which is that the intense, intense competition that we have fostered has created intense inequality. And, you know, that's socially disturbing and politically dysfunctional.
Thanks, David, for the call. We have just a minute to go. You mentioned you see changes, especially in the world of business. How do we encourage more collaboration as opposed to competition in all areas of life?
Well, I think the important thing is this, you know, this sentence from the chief executive of Ocean Spray, which is, you know, nobody wins unless everybody wins. And whether we're talking about families or schools or labs or companies, I think we need to bear in mind the incredible dependency we have on each other and recognize that real success is about making others successful.
Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Margaret Heffernan is an entrepreneur, chief executive, and author. Her most recent book is A Bigger Prize: How We Can Do Better Than the Competition. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Bill Martins for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. And I hope you join us tomorrow at this time. It's Friday, and that means it's time to review the top issues in politics in state and national news. It's our Week in Review coming up tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.